My name is Michael McCusker. I would like to begin the program with a sip of very good, hot, strong coffee and a letter that I've written to the Daily Astorian. This is in response to a letter that was written this last Friday, and I could not resist the opportunity. A recent letter to the Daily Astorian, Thugocracy, April 15th, essentially branded American working people as scum. What else can be interpreted from such intemperate remarks as union-induced riots in Madison, Wisconsin, have been an evil combination of cowardice, greed, hatred, threats, criminality, intimidation, and anarchy, and that's a quote, and that, quote, union mobs and their flunkies were turning the beautiful state capital and its grounds into a pigsty, unquote. The writer labeled ordinary working people, which include police, firefighters, and teachers, as hired gangs and union mobs and their flunkies, who are, in his words, associated with the union thugocracy. His taunts would seem laughably obscene if he had not exposed himself as a culpable wind-up toady to an extreme right-wing ideology that, stripped of its self-serving rhetoric, despises liberal democracy, as well as the rights and worthiness of ordinary people. He disingenuously neglected to remark on the Wisconsin governor's large tax breaks to his state's corporate hierarchy and to wealthy elite benefactors, which is a major source of the state budget shortfall, in tandem with the national economic collapse fomented by the nation's financial sector, not its ruthlessly disenfranchised labor force. The writer and his ilk, a favored term by right-wing pundits to vilify ideological enemies, do not simply criticize the fallible practices of democratic governance. They seem devilishly inspired to use its freedoms of expression to stifle and ultimately eradicate constitutional democracy entirely. The writer also appears to be disgusted by surges toward democracy in Arabic countries, which he compares to the aforementioned riots by the supposed union thugocracy. And that is something I wrote to the Daily Astorian, which may or may not print it. Eventually, either way. Well, Tuesday, April 19th, was the 18th birthday of my friend Alexia. April 19th was also the anniversary of the shot heard round the world at Concord and Lexington in 1775, the beginning of the American Revolution. And also Oklahoma City bombing of a homegrown terrorist. And that was in 1994, I believe. How soon I do forget. And it was the beginning of Dewey Canyon 3, which I have not forgotten, 40 years ago, in 1971, when members of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War from all over the country gathered in Washington, D.C., to register the protest of the Vietnam War. And I'd like to read an article that, or story, that I wrote about that event 40 years ago. I call it Tales of the Chicken Bleep or Defecation 20. Now, the term bleep is a useful one when you can't use certain words on radio at certain times of the day, supposedly because these are family radio stations. Of course, families, American families, have altered considerably since the iconic days of Ozzie and Harriet in the stereotypical 1950s, or the multi-generational families of predecessor centuries all the way back to the cave. So I will use that term bleep, and if I forget to use it and actually mention the horrifying word that it sort of disguises, my apologies. I start with a prologue of sorts. April 19th used to signify the day the American Revolution began in 1775. It was the day rebellious Minutemen faced the British Army at Lexington and Concord after being warned the Redcoats were coming by Paul Revere, etc. It was the day the shot heard round the world. That has changed. On April 19th, 1995, so that was the exact date, the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City was bombed by homegrown terrorists. 168 Americans, including children in a daycare center, died in the explosion. 500 were injured. April 19th was the date Vietnam veterans gathered in Washington, D.C. in 1971 to protest the war they had fought in and turned against. They likened themselves to the patriots who fought for liberty and freedom in the American Revolution and called themselves Winter Soldiers. They were the grunts of Vietnam veterans against the war, working off a bad war's bitter karma. Although there is a pervasive tendency in American society to rapidly move on from anything past as if nothing will stick if only we move hurriedly enough, war veterans are generally not able to throw off their horrible experiences, but instead relive them in nightmares not confined to sleeping. There are a million histories in the United States of America. This is one of them. And before I begin reading, I have the window open, so if you hear multitudinous sirens at this moment, that is the reason. A little fresh air into this vacuum of a studio. And also, I should probably give my disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos. Tales of the Chicken Defecation 20. A little more than a week before 20 of us hurled freshly shoveled chicken bleep onto the steps of the Pentagon, more than 1,000 of us hurled our combat medals over a barricade onto the steps of the United States Capitol. One man screamed out the names of his dead before he ripped the flashy pieces of tin off his tattered GI shirt and threw them like a long shot from left field. Another threw the cane he limped with from a wounded leg. Their faces were hard and angry as one by one they threw away their rewards for death. "The next time I pick up a rifle, it'll be to take this place," shouted one. "These are just garbage," said another. "I've got all these medals," a vet cried, "but the one I'm most ashamed of is my good conduct medal. I'm ashamed of my bleeping good conduct." Personal aside, I never did get a good conduct medal. They walked and limped and passed by in wheelchairs. Some had empty sleeves, one or two patches over empty eyes. The statue of John Marshall was slung with half a dozen articles of military uniforms dripping like green blood from his face and arms. Later, the medals were swept into a long pile in the form of a coffin, and a soldier's helmet was stuck on a long stick at its head. A week later, I was at the point of a small column of men crossing a railroad bridge over the Potomac River. We moved in a single file at a fast clip in case we were thought dangerous enough to shoot at, a combat patrol penetrating the Pentagon. At a distance behind, a force of soldiers and cops was attempting to catch up with us. Overhead, helicopters buzzed like crazed raptors unable to get at their prey. Behind us in the city, clouds of pepper and tear gas grayed the sky. Sirens screamed like hurt children. On the river below, a patrol boat swung around in tight circles while a man standing on deck shouted threats into a bullhorn, ignored by the 20 of us strung out on the long bridge from D.C. to Arlington, Virginia. I could barely make out the white walls of the cemetery where thousands of our dead were buried and where, the first time, we were refused entry by club-wielding police 2 weeks before. Perhaps our encampment of Vietnam veterans might have gone unnoticed if we had not been locked out of Arlington, but it was too much for the press to ignore. war veterans not allowed to visit their dead. Suddenly, all over the country, people began to pay attention to us. Scruffy, bearded and long-haired, stressed out, dope-smoking renegades wearing tattered, patchy assortments of uniforms, carrying plastic toy M16 rifles, chests beaming with tarnished medals and ribbons. Our purpose at Arlington was challenged. "You can't come in here because political demonstrations are not allowed," the cops said. And we answered, "These dead are manipulated to coerce others to die every time a politician comes here to lay a wreath and praise the dead for their noble sacrifice. We're here because these guys don't want you guys using the fact they're dead to get anybody else killed," one ex-soldier said. The gates to Arlington were open to us the next day, but the government denied that most of us were veterans, then denied making the charge when we proved our claim with personal military documents which we carried in anticipation that we would be accused of being frauds. We went to Washington, D.C. in delegations from every state, and for the week that we occupied the mall across from the Capitol, we killers remained peaceful, spreading like wildfire through the city, assaulting neighborhoods with our guerrilla theater of mock search and destroy that was so realistic people screamed in fear and anger as uniformed men with toy M16s, made by Mattel, pretended to beat and kill others dressed in pajamas and cone hats. Some of the actors were hurt because the soldiers sometimes forgot it was not for real, but they had accepted the risk from the start. We assaulted Congress mostly in a rude manner. Guerrilla theater on the Capitol steps ended with sheep's blood splattered on the porch, cutting through bureaucratic excuses and justifications, badgering even those reluctant to see us. "Open up, Buckley. We know you're in there," 50 New York vets shouted while pounding on the door of William F.'s brother, the senator. Not so much in hopes of any meaningful response, but more to give our representatives a good look at the monsters they helped create. At first, the government wanted to play what was known as the Daley game after the late mayor of Chicago, who kept anti-war demonstrators at the 1968 Democratic National Convention on the run, allowing them no place to settle and dialogue their opposition to Vietnam. The tactic did not work with us, essentially because we refused to move, and many of us, me included, were veterans of Chicago. We managed to get an appeal of an initial injunction to throw us off the mall. Then Supreme Court Chief Justice Berger threw out the appeal. Efforts to overrule him through legal means, including representation on our behalf by a former Attorney General, Ramsey Clark, failed. We voted to violate the stringent conditions of our being allowed to stay. We were not allowed to sleep or make preparations for sleep such as unrolling bedrolls, nor could we have fires or pitch tents. There was never any question about not staying. The vote was only whether we would sleep pretending to stay awake or sleep in outright civil disobedience. The federal police sided with us and pretended they did not see anyone sleeping. The next day, the order was rescinded. The mall was ours. A headline that day summed it well. Vets overrule Supreme Court. Columnist Mary McGrory wrote that our stubborn band of ex-warriors successfully stood off the government. In the meantime, several hundred active duty soldiers promised they would throw down their rifles if they were mobilized against us. So we stayed. On the last day, we threw our medals. A young Army officer read off the names of 34 officers who were resigning from the Army because of the Vietnam War, from a full bird colonel down. Throwing our medals at Congress was the last act of our show, which I underestimated as overly showy. A goodly portion of the American people thought our finale was an audacious and tragic gesture that, quote, won their hearts and minds, unquote. The day after we threw our medals, a huge march of 500,000 people tramped through the streets of Washington in opposition to Vietnam, the official body count of U.S. forces in Vietnam. We dug in for May Day, which was a week away. The last major demonstration of the old new left was planned for May Day and was intended to commit mass civil disobedience by creating mass chaos in Washington. The city was to be shut down for a morning at least. War resistors migrated into the city from all over the country in the following week. Although most of the vets had gone home, a few of us stayed and maintained a bunker watch over Algonquin City, a growing encampment in a park on the banks of the Potomac River, in which the bonus Army veterans had been shot and chased off in the 1930s. When cops finally raided us on the day before May Day, most of the ersatz medics were vets. No heads were broken because almost everyone left and set up scattered camps in 3 startled universities, 50 churches, and hundreds of private homes, and anywhere else anybody could find a place to wait for the next day's attempt to close down the government. Few expected to seriously interrupt the government or that the war would end as a result. What mattered was that several thousand American citizens were determined to commit civil disobedience on a scale never attempted in this country, with the possible exception of the Civil War. They intended to be arrested so they might take the war to court. Most of the Vietnam veterans who stayed for May Day were scattered among various delegations that planned to blockade the main targets of highway bridges into Washington and traffic circles inside the city to prevent as long and as often as possible federal workers from reaching their jobs. Those of us who wanted to act together as veterans planned the chicken bleep strike on the Pentagon. Some wanted to blow up the bridges and highways. The idea of throwing chicken defecation was an acceptable compromise. Just after midnight, a few of us prowled softly through dark Maryland fields to a chicken farm and filled several plastic bags with slimy, odoriferous substances from open coops. At dawn, we were on the road in a rented van. I don't remember which traffic circle we jumped into, but it was right in the middle of a large bust, cops and gas everywhere. We surprised the police by charging into them, which was how we survived ambushes in Vietnam. We ran down several streets with cops in pursuit, evading police vehicles and blocking forces setting up in front of us. Pure slapstick, a gaudy gang of movie villains chased by Keystone cops. We finally got onto a bridge after escaping a squadron of motorcycle cops popping off pepper gas clouds and managed to tie up traffic for a few minutes. Foot cops behind us shouted and blew whistles and tried to run through honking stalled cars. In front of us, a skirmish line of soldiers was attempting to sweep down on us. We responded as if we were back in combat. We took advantage of what was there, and it happened to be a stretch of railroad track. We jumped down onto the tracks and ran toward the river while cops and troops bumped into each other and acted confused about chasing us or staying in position on the bridge. Some finally came in pursuit, but by then we were far ahead. We didn't bother to duck reconnaissance helicopters, nervously assuring ourselves that they wouldn't hit us with rockets or machine gun fire. Several of us extended arms and upraised fingers at the pilots, and we cut a fast march across the long railway bridge over the Potomac River into Virginia. Cops waited for us on the opposite shore 100 yards down the spur. We took a different track. We went right around the edge of an Army headquarters camp, and by the time soldiers started climbing a few fences to get at us, we were long gone. The helicopters overhead went crazy. Voices from the air shouted at us to stop, but they were also too late. We approached an underpass, and on the highway above, police cars began to form up, and they were late. We dashed under the bridge and around a few boxcars standing on a siding along a high-wire fence. Soldiers were on the other side of the fence, but they just looked at us. We climbed a grassy knoll, and directly in front of us across a 2-lane highway was the low, flat Pentagon building. With hardly a word, we formed into a skirmish line and ran across the highway and onto the Pentagon lawn. We laughed and cheered until tears were in our eyes, hugging each other and dancing wildly. We had made it through every defense, past hundreds of cops and soldiers. Out of thousands who tried to penetrate the Pentagon that day, we were the only ones who reached it. The rest had been busted or turned away at the bridge with tear gas and clubs. The aging Dr. Benjamin Spock was among the gassed and arrested. We stopped laughing and formed into a column of twos and began to march. One counted cadence. Armed with a small plastic grenade or two of chicken bleep apiece, we marched past 2 surprised security cops who yelled frantically into 2-way pagers. Whoever was in charge of Pentagon security that day seriously neglected the inner defenses in favor of a tight ring outside. We marched around its sides past several shocked and enraged military officers, past a window from which a smiling woman formed a peace sign with her hand, past 2 more cops who tried to stop us. One of them grabbed at a bag, and it emptied on his shiny white uniform. We rounded a corner and suddenly found ourselves at the Pentagon's main entrance. The porch was crowded with high-ranking officers, a squad of bewildered cops, and several secretaries. We came to an orderly halt, did a right face, and snapped to attention. Then we attacked. Screams and shouts burst into shocked cadence with the nauseating plop of plastic bags smashed on cement as officers, cops, and secretaries scrambled for a single door in wild-eyed panic. An army major stepped forward to bark an order at us, then tore through a group of frightened women like a bowling ball in his haste to get inside the building. We went mad, the 20 of us, hurling our smelly little bombs everywhere. With our wild, maddened eyes and hoarse, laughing curses, we must have seemed like berserker Vikings. I began grabbing gobs of chicken stuff in my bare hands and running up the steps, throwing it at the windows, the glass door, the walls, heaping piles of it on the porch, slinging it at horrified faces pressed against the inside windows. Our attack lasted only a few minutes. After we exhausted our ammunition, the porch and windows resembling a scarred battlefield, we regrouped on the sidewalk, turned to the left, and began to march off. Our pursuers finally caught up with us. Armed soldiers came at us from front and rear, but a squad of club-wielding police reached us first. And so we were busted. "For foul defecation distribution," one of us laughed. We were searched. One ex-grunt dropped two joints into an FBI agent's coat pocket. Loaded onto a bus from which we jeered at passing army officers and various government employees, and sent off to a federal prison in Virginia, although an army enlisted driver purposely got us lost a few times. He winked at us while FBI agents frowned over a map. At the prison, we teased grim U.S. Marshals who were dressed in blue jumpsuits with shiny scarlet scarves tucked into their collars and shiny black boots on their feet. We assumed positions of POWs, hands flat atop our heads, giving out only names, dates of birth, rank, and serial numbers as specified in the U.S. Code of Military Justice. Our rallying cry became, "Free the Chicken Bleep 20. And our bail was set at $50 apiece, with a direct order we get out of D.C. within 3 hours, or the minimum sentence would be 30 days and most probably 90, according to a reproachful federal magistrate whose grim, bespectacled face resembled a Grant Wood portrait. It took us 8 hours to get out of jail, and by then more than 7,000 had been arrested for May Day disruptions," and that's a quote. It was the largest mass arrest ever made in any American city in a single day, and the jails and courts broke down. People were shoved into sports stadiums in the manner of South American countries during public roundups, and fences were broken down, allowing many to escape. The stadium was gassed several times when the prisoners got too unruly, and once the crowd toppled a goalpost. The next day, more than 3,000 submitted to arrest at the Justice Department. That day, thinking of 90 days, I was not particularly interested in being caught again and slipped out of the trap just before the back door slammed shut. Cops chased a friend and I down a block, but we lost them in a crowd. I was unable to get to the Capitol the following day. Cops were hard on the prowl for everybody on the move. I got a face full of gas but managed to evade arrest by ducking into a drugstore. A second try got more gas in my eyes, so I settled for a glass of red wine instead. The immediate reaction to our raid on the Pentagon was for the most part respectful from both soldiers standing picket line along D.C. streets and the freaks ducking in out of trouble. "You vets got your bleep together," was the usual term of approval. It was, of course, only a symbolic act carried out with a good deal of relish and humor. I believe that nearly everyone who has spent time in the military, that old chicken defecation outfit, has wished to do what we did. I thought throwing that chicken bleep at the Pentagon was a fitting and unmistakable escalation of throwing our war medals at Congress, a very robust and irreverent declaration of independence from the bloody brotherhood of war. And a little postscript. I have two layers of war buddies, the first from Vietnam and the other from the war against the war. Among the latter was Jack McCloskey, who died in February 1996, victim of a war that never stops killing. An orphan and a combat medic in Vietnam, he died of heart failure at age 53 in San Francisco. He was wounded twice as a medical corpsman with the USMC and received a Silver Star. His health never recovered from the war. He suffered various side effects from his wounds, Agent Orange exposure and post-traumatic stress disorder. He was a beacon of conscience in the VVAW and a pioneer of storefront veteran centers. Jack was a catalyst in the infant early 1970s movement that dealt with such issues as then unrecognized post-traumatic stress disorder, Agent Orange, alcoholism, suicide, joblessness, and other problems Vietnam veterans were facing, an article in the San Francisco Examiner said after his death. The Examiner wrote that when Jack returned from Vietnam, he found a nation tired of war and unwilling to accept its veterans back as it had those of previous wars. Vietnam veterans were invisible to most people. Those who did acknowledge us hated us because they knew the war was wrong and they had to blame somebody for it. So they blamed us, Jack told a reporter several years ago. He was a founder of Swords to Plowshares, one of the nation's premier veterans groups. Jack was one of the few people in the world that you can run across that you know has made this world a better place, Michael McCain of EVAW Buddy said of him. Tales of the Chicken Bleep 20 is dedicated to Jack with deep sorrow and immense respect. And I'd like to read an obit. Billy Bang, 63, violinist moved by Vietnam War, dies. Billy Bang, a violinist whose gritty, expressive, and spirited playing earned admiration in contemporary jazz circles, died on Monday at his home in Harlem. He was 63, and this is from the New York Times obits, April 17th, this last Sunday. The cause was complications of lung cancer, says Jean-Pierre Leduc, his friend and agent. Prominent as a band leader and a sideman throughout the 1980s and 90s, Mr. Bang achieved his most substantial success with the 2001 album Vietnam, The Aftermath, with featured music inspired by his time serving in the Army during the Vietnam War, played with peers who had also served. The album and a 2005 sequel, Vietnam Reflections, which included Vietnamese musicians, in turn inspired Redemption Song, a 2008 documentary film about him. And that was Billy Bang's. I just cut the obit short. But more or less Vietnam put him down after a lot of years of PTSD, you might say. Addictions to alcohol and drugs, and then cleaning himself out, and then just burying his soul. Well, tomorrow is Earth Day. I'd like to read a poem by Margaret Lee Bowler, Earth's Checklist, an Earth Day poem. Say what you think what you say, for what would Mother Nature do if she saw her Earth this way? If she saw all the pollution, all the smog, all the waste, all the careless forest fires, all the killings just from taste, all the rainforest destruction, the acid pouring from the sky, the shooting, the logging, killing species by and by, all the deadly fertilizer being sprayed upon the ground, the oil clogging up the beaches, yet the world is going round. What would Mother Nature do? What would Mother Nature do? First, she would put a stop to the pollution, clear the acid from the sky, prevent the careless forest fires, save each species by and by, stop the rainforest destruction and the smog and the waste, halt the shooting and most logging and the killings just from taste, ban the deadly fertilizer, start to clean up the ground, make our home a better place the whole world round. But Mother Nature softly speaks. Her voice is hard to hear. Yet when she is listened to, she can be heard from far and near. And listen to her closely, for we've got some things to do. Come on, come here, and pull up a seat, for you can help on Earth Day, too. Come, go get a move on. Stop the pollution and the waste. After all, we are the future. Make our Earth a better place. Happy Earth Day, everyone. And that was Margaret Lee Bowler. 11 or 12 when she wrote that in 2001. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.